You're listening to Sipping on Some Crime podcast, hosted by Aaron. This podcast covers sensitive and triggering subjects, explicit language, and mature content which may not be suitable for children. As always, all parties are innocent until proven guilty.
Today, I will be covering the Julie Monson case.
The unsolved murder of Julie Monson continues to haunt the city of Auburn. She was kidnapped off the streets at 2 a.m. September 28, 1981, 30 years ago.
Julie Monson was murdered in September of 1981. Cayuga County District Attorney Jim Vargason declined to comment on his investigation today.
So you have an individual who fits the description, has the characteristics of someone who would commit such a crime, and who has lied about his whereabouts on the night Julie Monson disappeared.
It's about the next victim and the corruption that's allowed a killer to walk free.
Julie's kidnapping and murder might be the most mysterious unsolved case that has left a lasting mark on the city of Auburn, New York. Throughout the years, Julie's case has seen its fair share of twists and turns, and as many believe, a corrupt investigation. 42 years later, despite an arrest and a conviction, Julie's case is still unsolved. Julie's family and friends would describe her as a happy person who had a good relationship with her parents, William and Melba, and was content living at home even at 18. Melba said they were very close and Julie was happy to be home while attending Cayuga Community College in Auburn. Julie planned to graduate from Cayuga and then attend an airline training school. And to those in that area, I apologize if I just butchered that name. Julie was close to her family and friends and decided to start at the local community college despite knowing she wanted some kind of job in the airline industry. Her mom says Julie just wasn't quite ready to be out on her own, and her family was supportive of her decision to stay close to home for a bit longer. September 27, 1981, Julie would be out attending a friend's birthday at a popular night spot, the Stockade, and would decide to head home around 2 a.m. Julie would last be seen around 2:30 a.m., just a short distance from her home on East Guinea Street in Auburn, New York, where she still lived with her parents. Witnesses would tell investigators that a tall, muscular, somewhat heavyset man with dark hair, driving what they believed to be a van, pulled up behind Julie's late model sports car on Prospect Street. Julie parked on the curb and the man in his van exited his vehicle just as Julie exited hers. Witnesses from the homes in the neighborhood said that the man had gestured to Julie's car's undercarriage as if there was a concern. Julie would then proceed to enter this man's van, and they would drive away. When Julie wasn't home in the morning, her father would call to report her missing after he found Julie's car abandoned on the side of the street about 3 miles from their home. Police would arrive on Prospect Street to investigate Julie's car. The car did not appear to have a flat tire, damage, or any mechanical issues. Julie's belongings were not in the car. Julie's car keys would be found on a lawn on Brister Avenue just around the corner from where Julie's car sat on Prospect Street. I, of course, will have a map showing you just how close Brister Avenue is to Prospect Street. It's literally one of the streets that you could turn off into a little neighborhood off of Prospect Street. But I will have them on my website for those that need the visual. Julie's parents were very persistent from the beginning with investigators that Julie wouldn't just run away and leave behind her life. She was happy in her life. And finding her keys on a random neighbor's lawn helped prove just that to investigators. Investigators began ground searches for Julie, and her parents waited desperately for a call from Julie to let them know she was okay. But that never came. That's when Julie's parents knew something was very wrong. Investigators would interview hundreds of people and pore over Julie's activities in the months and weeks leading up to her disappearance. Their hope was to find any clues as to who this unknown man that had last been seen with Julie was. But nothing led them closer to Julie or that unknown man. In April, 6 months after Julie vanishes, a truck driver from Buffalo would find a purse belonging to Julie in Seneca Falls and notify investigators. There is a bit of confusion for me personally after reading through every newspaper I could get my hands on, starting in 1982 through 2023. In these articles, there's a wallet or purse mentioned as the item found. And as someone that's carried a purse before, I can tell you that there is a big difference, and most people realize that a purse to a wallet is a huge difference. However, out of all the articles I've combed through, purse seems to be the most consistent description of what the trucker found. So that's what I'm going to stick with here. Investigators searched the area the truck driver found Julie's purse, and 3 days into their search, as they were searching along an area off of Lake Road, they would discover the jacket Julie was wearing when she was abducted. Julie's jacket was found about a quarter mile away from where the truck driver found her purse. Many psychics early on in the search for Julie would suggest to investigators that Julie's remains would be discovered in Seneca Falls. So this felt like a strong lead in the right direction for investigators and breathed new life into Julie's case. A year later in September of 1982, Chief Bertonica stated they had a man they were interested in and had been investigating as the man that abducted Julie, but they were staying tight-lipped about who it was. Investigators believe this man followed Julie home from the bar and intentionally persuaded her to leave her car behind and enter his. Cayuga County District Attorney Ross Tasiki, on the other hand, made it clear that Bertonica had yet to produce enough evidence against this person of interest to be able to bring charges before a grand jury. Tasiki would not speculate on whether the evidence pointed to the possibility that Julie was deceased, and said he would not be granting immunity from prosecution for this suspect in return for Julie's whereabouts. Investigators a year in were really using every tool at their disposal and more to find Julie, and had called in several psychics along with two nationally known ones, one from New Jersey and another from Texas, to assist in Julie's case. Each psychic would be given the chance to handle and sit with some of Julie's possessions, as well as speak to Julie's parents. Several of the psychics have come to the conclusion that Julie was murdered, and even have led investigators on ground searches, only to return empty-handed. In May of 1982, a Texas psychic, John Ketching, who lives and works in Dallas, would tell investigators that they should search the abandoned Lehigh Valley Railroad bed between Garden and East Bayard Street. Ketchings would tell investigators he was positive that Julie was out there and, quote, can point out the spot that she's going to be found within 100 yards of where I say they should look, unquote. Ketchings told investigators a very detailed scenario. He believed that Julie was abducted, sexually assaulted, and killed. His vision matched another psychic that investigators were working with, John Durham of Woodby Heights, New Jersey. This gave investigators hope, but unfortunately, neither Durham or Ketchings were able to bring investigators closer to discovering Julie or who took her. Melba told the Democrat and Chronicle paper September 1982 that, quote, every time the phone rings, every time the doorbell rings, every time a car pulls into the driveway, we jump. To us, the day that Julie disappeared is a day that has never ended, unquote. By December of 1982, Julie's parents had nearly tripled the reward amount for a verifiable information about Julie's disappearance. That December, the reward stood at $28,000 for anyone that was able to provide information about Julie's whereabouts or leads to the identification and apprehension and conviction of anyone criminally responsible for Julie's disappearance. There would also be five other rewards in the amount of $3,200 for information leading investigators to physical clues they could use to connect to Julie's case. Investigators were really looking for key information, like how Julie's car keys ended up on Brister Avenue in the neighbor's lawn, how the purse got to Lake Road in Seneca Falls, how Julie's coat was placed about a block away on the roadside, and of course, most importantly, investigators wanted to know the identification of the driver that Julie was last seen with and what model and make of vehicle they were driving when they stopped Julie on Prospect Street. Britannica would deliberately withhold information in this case from the public, but was definitely hoping to receive more tips with the additional reward money. The information that they were seeking for specific items were attached to posters along with the rewards, the amount, and how to collect the reward. A picture of Julie that was taken on her 18th birthday would also be attached. Officers also said that they would be willing to take other verifiable information not requested on the poster, and if they were able to verify it, discuss a reward amount for that information. At the end of 1982, Britannica did tell a local news reporter that he continued to receive tips about this case, and he even had an appointment next week with someone who he would not identify. In April of 1983, skeletal remains would be discovered by Pamela Decker, a Finger Lakes Community College student who was taking samples in the main pool marsh of Montezuma National Park. The remains were located about 50 feet from the thruway and 50 feet from the dirt access road that connects to the self-guided tour for visitors, which was also just about shy of 10 miles from Seneca Falls, which is where a majority of psychics that investigators and Julie's family worked with said they would find her remains. So it wasn't Seneca Falls, but it was really close. And when I put up a map on the website and socials, you'll be able to see kind of how Seneca Falls, Montezuma National Park, and Auburn are all in proximity of one another. The remains were only concealed by sight by 6-foot-tall cactails. Grady E. Hocut, the recce manager, said Decker is one of the number of students from various locations and colleges taking random soil samples to help test for salt, cadmium, and lead that can seep into their waterways due to salt being laid on the roads in the winter. When investigators arrived to the scene, led by Trooper Captain Ronald R. Brooks and 15 troopers, they combed the area, shoveling the dirt below the remains into a closed truck to take to Syracuse for further examination. Their hope was that between the plant life samples that were with the remains and the FBI examination of clothing, they would get a better idea of how long the remains had been there. The remains would be identified April 8, 1983, as Julie Marie Monson. Investigators stated that they used dental record X-rays taken 8 days before Julie's abduction, along with jewelry and clothing found with the remains to identify Julie. As of April 9, 1983, investigators were not calling it a homicide yet. They were calling it a case of an unattended death. Julie's remains would be taken to Onondaga County Medical Examiner's Office for an autopsy to be performed. At the time, investigators could not determine how long the remains had been at the refuge. Melba and William were notified that remains had been found at the refuge the previous night, and before even having a positive identification of these remains as Julie's, Melba would simply say, quote, "It's over," unquote. 3 days later, April 12, 1983, investigators would say that it might be impossible to determine Julie's cause of death. Seneca County Coroner Warren Jones would spend the day in Onondaga County Morgue in Syracuse as the experts began their detailed examination of Julie's remains. Due to the condition of the remains, they were worried it may make it impossible to determine how Julie died. Without a determination of death pointing towards murder, investigators were going to find it much more difficult to charge a suspect if it's classified as an unintended death. Chief Britannica believes Julie was murdered and said, quote, "If there is no cause of death determined by the coroner, I guess all the police involved will get our heads together and figure out where to go," unquote. Investigators and coroners believe that Julie's remains had probably been at the wildlife refuge for the past 18 months. And investigators with the state police also sent bits of Julie's clothing to the Federal Bureau of Investigation Laboratory in Washington, D.C. for them to assist with more forensic analysis. The New York State Police Bureau of Investigations joined forces with Auburn Police Department and the FBI. The state's police bureau said that the special BCI team was working on the keys found on the lawn in Brister Avenue. They released a statement saying, quote, "Significant information is being developed," unquote. They declined to offer further explanation. Investigators were still asking the public for help with Julia's case, that if they had information, to please come forward. By October 1984, it was reported that despite their best efforts and the state police taking over the investigation, along with working with the FBI, with all the clothing and soil samples sent, unfortunately, Seneca County Coroner Warner Jones said they used extensive forensic testing and still failed to pinpoint the cause of Julie's death. County District Attorney Carbonaro told the local paper Democrat and Chronicle on October 9, 1984, that they did plan to convene a grand jury for Julie's case, but they weren't going to say when because they didn't want to be faced with a throng of reporters. Carbonaro would say, quote, "Even after the grand jury completes its investigation, I may not be able to discuss the case in any detail. What I have to say will depend on what the grand jury determines," unquote. Carbonaro said that he would not decide whether to ask for an indictment until after the grand jury had interviewed all of the witnesses. State police investigator Donald Brandsetter was now the head of the investigation, and he had no qualm sharing with reporters that investigators had centered in on a single prime suspect who could be charged with Julie's death. However, when reporters asked Carbonaro about Brandsetter's comments, he refused to comment. Carbonaro also refused to comment on the recent decision to place the case before the grand jury, whether that was connected with other potential grand jury witnesses or new suspects in the case, or whether any witnesses are now in custody for any reason. In 1982, Tasiki refused to present Julie's case to a grand jury, despite Britannica's persistence that he had a suspect that he felt like there was enough evidence to charge with, at the very least, kidnapping. At this time, Julie's parents, Melba and William, were no longer speaking with the press. Investigators said that they are aware that Carbonaro announced that he was asking for a grand jury to investigate their daughter's death, but no longer wanted to comment on it. They recently moved from their former home on East Ganesh Street in Auburn to a large home where Melba told reporters yesterday her and her husband, quote, "have put many things behind us," unquote, and they do not want to talk about Julie's case. Reporters spoke to a former neighbor who asked to remain anonymous that said that Melba and William seemed to have come to terms with Julie's death. The house that they shared on East Ganesh Street held too many memories for them. They said, quote, "Bill and Melba had a very hard time coping at first, but now it's been 3 years and they seem to be able to go on with their lives. They've always been a close couple, and if anything, they're closer than ever now. Their son Charles was married this summer, and his wife's name was Julie Marie, just like Julie. I think they can go together in their new house. I think they are at peace." Unquote. There are a few different articles that mention Julie's brother, Charles, who I believe was 22 at the time that his sister disappeared, and it sounds like he would finish community college and come back home and be with his parents and put his career on hold for a couple of years to be support for one another when Julie first vanished. So my hope is their neighbor is right, that even in so many unknowns that they have been able to find their peace about Julie's kidnapping and murder, because in the end, that's why any of us do this, is to help the family find their peace. And their peace looks different for every single family member. Don't ever assume what a family member's peace looks like. You can ask them, but remember, they don't owe you the answer. October 29, 1984, a Cayuga County grand jury would begin hearing testimony Monday, October 29th in Julie's case. A total of 15 witnesses were subpoenaed to appear before the grand jury, proving the 1981 disappearance and apparent murder of Julie. Carbonaro stated that the goal with this grand jury would be to be able to get the witnesses' testimony on record before this case gets any older. Carbonaro could not comment on if he had a particular suspect in mind that he was focusing on, and he also would not say whether he planned to seek a murder indictment or not. Carbonaro was hopeful moving forward with the grand jury that witnesses could open up more with the threat of criminal contempt charges being held against them. Carbonaro said, quote, "There are certain witnesses that I believe will be more likely to open up under the compulsion of the grand jury setting than any other way. It's one thing to be interviewed by a police officer and to know that you don't have to say anything if you don't want to. But it's another thing entirely to be summoned before a grand jury and face possible contempt charges for refusing to testify. This is an investigation, and indictment is possible. Whether we request an indictment and charge the grand jury with the law depends on the outcome of the investigation." Unquote. Police Chief Britannica told reporters that he too believed there were people that knew much more about Julie's case than they were saying. November 1983, six witnesses would be recalled after their testimony to the grand jury in October. They were asked to come back to either clarify information from their first testimony or because of tips and/or questions investigators had after their testimony. November 13, 1983, close to a dozen state city police descended upon a snow-covered field near Alco Incorporated on Route 5 and 20 for clues that could help them in Julie's case. The field of interest was around 15 miles from where Julie's remains were found and about 2 miles from Prospect Road, where Julie was last seen with the unknown male suspect. While investigators would not divulge to the public what they were looking for in that field and what it had to do with Julie's case, they did say it was due to a recent development in Julie's case, but would not elaborate whether it was from recent testimonies from the grand jury probe or not. A team of officers led by Captain J. Heritage of the State Police searched the field as well as the old railroad house off of Orchard Street. Information about if they found anything in that search was never released to the public. The remaining witnesses they had recalled to testify wrapped up before Thanksgiving, with Carbonaro still feeling like witnesses were holding back essential information. Carbonaro said he had yet to decide whether to proceed with perjury or criminal charges against those witnesses he feels are hiding information. The grand jury would convene November 28th after a 2-week recess to speak to more witnesses in Julie's case. Initially, it was 15 witnesses of interest with 6 called back, and now there was a total of 19 witnesses and more to come. It would be July 1985 when an arrest would be made in the murder and disappearance of Julie. Donald Brandstetter said police interviewed literally thousands of people and several hundred witnesses to gather evidence in his arrest. Brandstetter said the delay after the grand jury conviction was due to some witnesses not being available when needed. Thomas Bianco was a past boyfriend of Julie's and on investigators' radar early in the investigation. Thomas's attorney, William Lynn of Syracuse, said he would not seek to have the trial moved, even though there has been wide media coverage of Julie's case. However, he does caution that picking a jury out of Cayuga County could be difficult due to the fact that most potential jurors have most likely been exposed to Julie's case in one way or another, even if it's just through minimal media coverage. Defense Lynn said that it is in his opinion Carbonaro's handling of Julie's case involved witnesses, intimidation, and that he believes even prosecutors had tried to get the grand jury witnesses to change their testimony. Lynn would tell reporters that investigators had been stalking out Thomas's auto body garage and had gone as far as planting listening devices there. Defense attorney Lynn would go on to describe that Thomas Calcibetta, who testified twice in front of the grand jury, said in 1982 that he knew nothing about Julie's case. Calcibetta would be charged with first-degree perjury and first-degree criminal contempt in connection in his first testimony in October 1984. Calcibetta would be arrested June 14, 1985, shortly after his former girlfriend told investigators that Thomas had told his girlfriend he had lied to the grand jury in October of 84. Carbonaro would not give details how Calcibetta's testimony led to Bianco's arrest. Melba would give a statement after press reached out saying, quote, "Of course the family is relieved something is being done," unquote, but offered no further comment. Thomas Bianco was born and raised in Auburn and is part owner of T&J West End Auto Body Shop. He and his business partner, Jeff Carnesili, have owned and operated the shop since September of 1984. Jeff said he was completely shocked when officers arrived on July 5th to arrest Thomas. Thomas would be granted bail with a bond of $100,000 and be released over the first weekend of August 1985. Thomas was 23 at the time of the arrest. Thomas's official charges were two counts of murder, attempted sodomy, kidnapping, and rape. Those charges were based on the grand jury after listening to about 30 witness statements before they handed down the sealed indictment. December 7, 1985, defense lawyers and Thomas's homicide case were able to get a bloodstained grocery bag found in the trunk of Thomas's car during a search in May 1982, 8 months after Julie's abduction, dismissed from evidence in his trial. In a separate ruling, Judge Donald Windsor dismissed the charge of attempted sodomy and first-degree rape. Bianco's lawyer, Lynn, told reporters, quote, "This is a major victory in our judgment. We are very pleased. When you have to deal with those crimes, it puts such an emotional theme on the case. Now we are facing a homicide. In my judgment, a jury can deal more effectively with this charge when it's not jumbled up with sex crimes," unquote. In November 1985, reporters would get wind that Bianco was hospitalized for several weeks in May 1982 at Hutchins Psychiatric Center in Syracuse. Reporters would ask Lynn if he was going to use the so-called insanity defense when it came to the pending trial January 2nd of 1986. Lynn said that his team decided against using it and they believed the strategy was so that Lynn would not be required to give the district attorney's office a copy of a report based on the psychiatric examination of Bianco ordered last month by the defense team. This in turn also meant that the prosecutors would not be able to order their own psychiatric exam of Bianco. Cayuga County District Attorney Paul R. Carbonaro told reporters that he was planning to call up to 9 witnesses in the trial that would be able to testify that they heard Bianco admit to being responsible for Julie's death. Those close to Julie and investigators were desperate to keep this trial from turning into a circus. Sheriff Sponable would say, in his 20 years as a sheriff, he had never seen any other trial draw this much attention in Cayuga County. Sponable said about the trial starting February 8, 1986, quote, "There's been 4 years of publicity about this case after all, and people have been following it all along. They've been calling here asking about getting seats saved, but a lot of people may be disappointed if they show up here tomorrow because they won't get in," unquote. Chief Sponable said his office, the district attorney's office, the clerk of court's office, and numerous other people have been receiving calls of people giving reasons to reserve seats and, even worse, asking if they could buy tickets. Sheriff Sponable said, "To be clear, the only seats reserved will be for a few reporters, and those will be on first-come basis. He will have extra security around the court just due to the attention that this case is already drawing." Judge Windsor, the original judge that was proceeding over this case, would drop out of the case because in between January and February, at some point, Windsor was offered a recommendation for federal judgeship. So a new judge, Judge Crewe, was assigned to the case in January of 86. While out on bail, Thomas Bianco refused to be interviewed by anyone and continued working in his body shop while awaiting trial. Before the arrest, once Julie's remains were discovered and confirmed, Julie's parents really stepped back and were not giving any interviews at all. There was brief statements that they made after Bianco was arrested, and I feel based on their very brief statements, a reporter asked Julie's mother if they were relieved that arrest had been made, because Melba's response was, "Of course." February 20th, 1986, D.A. Carbonaro's opening statement to the jury would lay out the scene of Julie's abduction and her death in the way that they believed everything happened based on their evidence and witness statements. Carbonaro told the jurors, "We're going to paint the picture the night that Julie was abducted. We will show you how her killer had ran her down with his car and stabbed her multiple times in the chest, due to the fact that she refused to do a sexual favor for said killer. We will show, based on the autopsy, that Julie's leg was broken before she died." Carbonaro told them that his witnesses and evidence would reveal even more news about the complicated four-year-old case. Carbonaro said that he would show that Julie, quote, "was tricked into the defendant's vehicle, that after Julie got into the defendant's vehicle, the defendant attempted to have Julie perform oral sex on him. When she refused, he attempted to restrict her physical movements by use of intimidation. He ran her down with his auto, breaking her leg. When she tried to run away, he jumped on top of her and stabbed her repeatedly in the chest," unquote. Carbonaro would tell jurors that Thomas Bianco became a suspect in May 1982, 8 months after Julie's disappearance, when he told friends and his parents that he was responsible for Julie's death. However, Carbonaro said that wasn't the only witness statements that brought them to Bianco. But in August of 1982, Bianco was said to have told a friend details about how he murdered Julie in such a way that it will become clear that only the one who had murdered Julie would know those details. Carbonaro points out that this testimony is so damning because they got this statement in 1982 and they hadn't even found Julie's remains until 1983. Bianco's defense attorney, Lynn, would give his opening statement next, asking the jury to avoid trying to guess missing pieces of the puzzle. Lynn went on to say he could not deny that in May 1982, Thomas had, quote, "made certain remarks to his friends, but we want you to carefully scrutinize the atmosphere under which those admissions were made. You will hear there was a lot of mumbling incoherently. A lot of what he said didn't jibe with what the friends were reading in the paper to the extent that the evidence is lacking in the case. I submit that you'd be doing a disservice by filling in those blanks yourself by speculating," unquote. Lynn went on to say that he does believe the proof that Julie was sexually assaulted. However, he's going to prove that Bianco was not the one that sexually assaulted Julie. Lynn asked the jury to pay attention to witnesses' descriptions of the man last seen talking to Julie on Prospect Street. He pointed to Bianco as he sat behind the defense table and asked them, looking at Bianco for themselves, did he match the person's description as a muscular man who stood considerably taller than 5'7"? Bianco is a medium height and medium build, and no one could testify that they had seen Bianco in any of the places Julie was at that night. Lynn said, quote, "The fact is, and the proof will show, that Thomas Bianco barely knew the victim," unquote. Lynn would go on to explain to the jury that three witnesses, to include Melba, stated that they knew Thomas and Julie had met in 1978 because they were both on the chorus in Auburn High School, and they did date for about a maximum of 2 weeks. Melba would be called to the stand to testify. She held tight a handkerchief and fought hard to keep her voice steady and clear as she was asked to describe what Julie was wearing the night she vanished. Melba would identify each item her daughter was wearing that night, piece by piece: a black sweater, a pair of brown clogs, a tan corduroy blazer, and some jewelry, along with a pair of blue jeans. Melba would again testify that her and William called the police the next morning after finding Julie's car abandoned. William would say on the stand, quote, "I thought something was probably wrong just knowing Julie. I felt something was wrong when I found her car," unquote. Thomas Calisabetta would be one of the first witnesses to testify. Calisabetta would tell jurors that sometime in August 1982, him and Bianco had had a conversation about Julie's murder at a bar north of Ithaca in Tompkins County. Calisabetta would say that they ended up getting together shortly after Bianco had undergone treatment at the Syracuse Hutchings Psychiatric Center. Calisabetta would detail how Bianco had explained to him that he had wanted to have sex with Julie and that Julie, quote, "got out of the car and started to run and he chased her with the car," unquote. He went on to say, just like Carbonaro's opening statement, that Bianco then stabbed Julie, but he said Bianco told him he would never admit to the murder. Calisabetta said Bianco said to him, quote, "he told me that if I ever said anything, he would deny it and that I'd go to prison and he'd get off because he was in Hutchington's institution," unquote. Calisabetta also testified that him and Bianco had been friends for about 10 years and have lived near each other in Auburn, so they did have a close relationship. Bianco's defense attorney would tell the jury that Carbonaro's pressured Calisabetta to make up this story about this conversation that never happened between Bianco and Calisabetta. Lynn would argue that Carbonaro had told Calisabetta he didn't believe his first statements when he was first interviewed and that he charged him with committing perjury. Lynn pointed out that Calisabetta at one point was under indictment for perjury and contempt during the grand jury probe of Julie's death, and that's when he would decide to tell the story of Thomas admitting to him that he had killed Julie, and that only came after pressure by the district attorney. Lynn said, quote, "consider the concept of a person like Tom Calisabetta being in jail 20 days facing a perjury charge. You've got to remember what he was facing, 25 years to life. He was telling the truth to the grand jury the first time when he said he didn't remember hearing anything about the case from Tom Bianco," unquote. Lynn would tell the jury that Carbonaro charged Calisabetta with perjury to push him to change his story in exchange for dropping the perjury and contempt charges. Once Calisabetta testified again before the grand jury in July in 1985, those charges of perjury and contempt were just dismissed. Carbonaro would tell jurors the evidence and witness statements continuously point back to Bianco and the story he told many people about what happened that night with Julie. Carbonaro held up a dirty, torn piece of a white brassiere and asked the jury to look closely at the bra as he passed it to each juror, saying, You can examine it yourself, and you will see the cuts that the FBI technicians describe as stab marks. Carbonaro would explain to jurors that Dr. Janice Ross, the pathologist who performed the autopsy on Julie's remains in 83, would indicate that the night that Julie died, her leg had been broken by being struck on the side shortly before her death. This was noted by Dr. Ross in her report before Calisabetta would give his statement about what Bianco told him happened that night Julie was murdered. Carbonaro also wanted to submit into evidence that they had received an anonymous tip about the location of Julie's body January 4th, 1983. Auburn lawyer David Weinstein would tell investigators that he received an anonymous phone call from a woman speaking with a New York City accent who would tell him that Julie's body was in the Montezuma National Wildlife Refuge. Weinstein would say, quote, "I have my suspicion who the woman was, but I couldn't be sure," unquote. He was unable to tell whether the woman's accent was real or fake. Since investigators were unable to identify or locate this woman, her testimony could not be permitted in the trial because it's considered hearsay and not admissible as evidence at this point. Julie's friends, Carol Hickey Stevens and Anne Granny, would also testify in court about the events that took place when they last saw Julie. Carol and Anne would tell jurors that the night of September 26, 1981, Julie, Carol, and Anne had all gone to a party in a couple of bars in the Auburn area. They bought and consumed most of a 28-pack of Guinness's cream ale. Anne said she went home at midnight, and Carol said her and Julie decided to head to the Stockade Bar on Route 5, and they were there till about 2:15 a.m. when Julie decided she was ready to head home. Carol and Julie left at the same time, Julie by herself and Carol with her boyfriend, now husband. Both Carol and Julie's vehicles would pull out of the parking lot at the same time. Carol would never see Julie again. February 25th, 1986, a friend of Bianco's, John Bazanarchi, would testify in May 1982 that Bianco had told him he felt responsible for the disappearance and death of Julie. John would say, quote, "He told me he thought he had something to do with the disappearance of Julie Monson. He said, 'I think I killed her,'" unquote. Angela Colvin would also testify. She is John's fiance, and both of them told similar versions of the story. They both said Bianco told them and others at John's house on the night of May 8, 1982, that he was responsible for Julie's murder and continued to tell them again on the following day. Both Angela and John would testify that Bianca spoke erratically and in fragmented sentences, often stopping to stare into space while repeating bits and pieces of a disjointed tale. Angela would tell the jury that she was in John's kitchen when Bianco arrived and, quote, "came in looking at me kind of off the wall and asked me to go out in his van. When I got out there, he kept hitting the steering wheel and saying, 'I'm the reason Julie is missing,'" unquote. Angela, John, and Bianco would return to the house, and then, in the kitchen, Bianco continued to insist that he was responsible for Julie's disappearance. John saying, quote, "He was just saying words. They weren't making any sense. It was kind of crazy. He wasn't acting right, not at all there," unquote. Both Angela and John said that Bianco had told them the same story that Carbonaro just told the jury about what happened to Julie the night she disappeared. As the trial went on, witness statements about the man seen talking to Julie on Prospect Street would not match the description of Bianco when it came to height. William Komanecki and his son Andrew were the witnesses that saw Julie talking to the man on Prospect Street, and they said the man appeared to be much taller than Julie, as much as 6 inches taller, whereas Bianco is 5'10 and Julie was 5'7, so there was a bit of discrepancy there. Lynn didn't just want to point out that this was a bit of a discrepancy. He wanted the jury to visualize the height difference. Lynn would ask a few of the female witnesses that shared Julie's height to demonstrate Bianco's height against Julie's. Lynn would ask Carol when she was on the stand to step down, take off her shoes, and stand back to back with Bianco. Bianco was about 5'9 and Julie was 5'7, and she was wearing 3-inch heels, which were recovered near her remains. So that would have made her the equivalent or close to the equivalent height of Bianco, which wouldn't match the 3 witness statements saying that the man talking to Julie that night on Prospect Street was almost 6 inches taller than Julie. February 28, 1986 would be the last day of witness testimonies. 3 of Bianco's friends would give testimony stating that during an extended visit to Florida in 1983, that Bianco would tell them he was a suspect in Julie's disappearance. When Bianco was staying in Florida, he had a roommate that he lived with briefly named Mark Anderson. Mark would testify that Julie's case was discussed at Bianco's birthday party in 1983. Mark testified, quote, "At the party, Tom said something to the effect, 'Well, of course I'm not stupid. Of course I raped her before I killed her,' unquote." Michael J. Scott would be another witness who would repeat the same conversation. They both said they didn't believe Thomas was serious at the time. Before any more testimony, Judge Crew would begin the day by saying he decided to deny a defense motion to dismiss the kidnapping charges, and he was refusing to dismiss the 2 murder charges. 2 of the last witnesses that would testify were former girlfriends of Bianco's, Diana Yankton and Megan Mahoney, both from Auburn. Megan would testify that Bianco and her began dating after September 27th of 1981. Megan said Bianco and her were dating for about a month after they met October 2nd, 1981 at a bar near Waterloo. Megan, who worked and lived near Montezuma National Wildlife Refuge in Tyree, said that her and Bianco broke up after, quote, "just a falling out," unquote. Diana said that her and Bianco would begin a relationship somewhere in November 1981 that ended around 4 months later. She said she wore Bianco's ring for the duration of that relationship, and after they broke up, when she gave Bianco the ring back, Bianco had already begun dating a former girlfriend, Macy Rogers. Defense lawyer Lynn would ask both Diana and Megan if they could describe how Bianco handled their breakup, and in both instances, Justice Crew sustained Carbonaro's objections to the question. Special Agent Rawalt, an FBI geology expert in his 12-minute testimony as the very last witness of the trial, would tell the jury that the remains of Julie were buried somewhere else in a sandy-type soil long enough to begin decomposition before it was dug up and moved to Montezuma. Rawalt's testimony would be around 12 minutes and consist mostly of information centered around where Julie's remains were found and the underlying soils that they discovered in the examination of the skeletal remains. March 7th of 1986, the defense for Bianco rested Thursday after calling 5 witnesses. The prosecution in total called 30 witnesses over 6 days, trying to prove to the jury that Bianco abducted Julie, drove his car into her, and stabbed her, all because she rejected his sexual advances. Bianco was never called to the stand and never took the stand, an option his defense team decided. His defense attorney, Fahey, would say they didn't believe it was necessary to put Bianco on the stand, saying, quote, "The proof is pretty obvious Thomas was not responsible for the death of Julie Monson," unquote. State Supreme Court Justice Crew would send the jury home for the weekend and schedule a lawyer's summation and his charges to the jury for Monday, March 10, 1986. The jury would return Monday, March 10, 1986 to begin deliberation. It would be 3 days and nearly 20 hours before the jury came to a decision. Reporters say it was an electric atmosphere at the moment they announced in the court that they had a verdict at 2:45 p.m. As reporters, employees, spectators all filed back into the courtroom to hear the verdict, Justice Bruce Crew issued a very stern warning to the courtroom, saying, quote, "Ladies and gentlemen, I am fully aware of some of the emotion that has been involved in this event, in the community, and I am cognizant of the strong feelings that it has engendered. However, these 12 people who are members of the jury would not choose to serve in that capacity if it were not their duty. They have worked very hard to reach a verdict. Whatever that verdict is, I do not want anyone in this courtroom to degrade them by any means whatsoever. I do not want any outbreak in this courtroom," unquote. At 3:08 p.m., the courtroom fell utterly silent as they awaited for the jury foreman, Raymond Miner, to read the verdict out loud. The 8-woman, 4-man jury had found Bianco guilty of first-degree kidnapping, intentional second-degree murder, and felony murder. Reporters said that Bianco sat absolutely still and showed no reaction as the foreman read the verdict. Bianco sat in Cayuga County Jail awaiting sentencing, while defense lawyers argued that the verdict should be set aside because Julie's remains and possessions were found in Seneca County, and Cayuga County Court had no jurisdiction to try anyone for her murder or kidnapping. March 29, 1986, Justice Crew denied a defense motion for dismissal of the verdict rendered March 12th, where the Cayuga County Supreme Court jury found Bianco guilty of first-degree kidnapping, intentional second-degree murder, and second-degree murder occurring in connection with another crime. Judge Crew ruled that Cayuga County courts have jurisdiction to hear the case against Bianco. In the 6-page decision filed previously, Crew ruled there was significant evidence present at Bianco's trial to allow the jury to conclude that Bianco kidnapped Julie in Cayuga County. On May 6, 1986, Bianco was sentenced to serve 3 consecutive terms of 25 years to life. In August of 1986, Bianco would be denied a new trial. Bianco's lawyer, William Lynn, filed a notice of appeal in the Appeal Division of State Supreme Court in Rochester. Justice Bruce Crew would rule against a new trial for Bianco, who now was an inmate at the Winday Prison in Allendon. Crew's decision stated that there was no bias for a defense claim that prosecutors withheld information about other possible suspects during the trial. Bianco's defense lawyers were seeking a new trial on the basis of media reports that there were several possible other suspects' names reported to police who were investigating Julie's disappearance. However, Justice Crew ruled that he didn't believe there were factual basis true enough to compel him to examine the prosecutor's files about these other possible suspects. Bianco's lawyer, Lynn, would say he was disappointed at the ruling because their hope would be that the judge would agree with the defense's contention that Bianco had been singled out as a suspect without an adequate investigation of all other possibilities of suspects by investigators. However, Justice Crew noted that Cayuga County District Attorney Paul Carbonaro said several times that he had given the defense lawyers all the material they were entitled to by law to have for the trial. In September 1987, Bianco's lawyers would present arguments before the Appellate Division of State Supreme Courts that Bianco's guilty verdict should be set aside and a new trial ordered. Lynn would tell the appellate justices that he believed Bianco's trial was hampered by the fact that there could have been other suspects other than Thomas that Julie could have been trying to avoid the night she disappeared. He also stated that some witnesses were prohibited by Justice Crew from answering some of the defense's questions. In the completed written appeal submitted by Lynn, the defense contends that there were stories published in the media after Bianco's trial that showed that the police and the Cayuga County District Attorney's Office had other suspects besides Bianco, none of which were presented at the trial. Carbonaro stands firm that there were no suspects besides Bianco. and that he didn't believe there were any errors made in the trial that were serious enough to warrant a new trial. In February 1988, Bianco's appeal would be rejected. District Attorney Carbonaro would receive a letter dated February 3rd from Judge Joseph Bellicosa stating that the Court of Appeals would not entertain an appeal for Bianco. Bianco's lawyers again would file motions in the State Supreme Court of Cayuga County saying that they had new evidence pointing to an overwhelming pattern of prosecutorial misconduct in Bianco's case and requested once again a new trial. In the motion filed on March 1991, Bianco's lawyer, Fahe, would claim that the Cayuga County District Attorney's Office suppressed evidence from a jail inmate that may have implicated others in the case of Julie's disappearance, to include a Cayuga County judge's son. Inmates in another witness statement from a man named Mark Sweeting told the DA before Bianco's trial that, in fact, Calisabetta had told him that he and two others were actually the ones that sexually assaulted and killed Julie, and one of the other people that was with him that night was John Corning, the son of Cayuga County Judge Peter Corning. This motion stated that Bianco's defense team believes that Carbonaro intimidated Calisabetta into making up this conversation between him and Tom at the bar by keeping him in jail and having County District Attorney Dennis Sater asking bail's bondsmen to refuse to issue a bond for Calisabetta so they could keep the pressure on him to get him to change his story. Mark Sweeting, who was an inmate at the time with Calisabetta, signed a sworn witness statement that was included with the motion's request. According to the appeal, the prosecution's star witness, which all of this testimony hinged on, Calisabetta, would go to state police last March recanting his testimony, telling state police investigators that he was pressured to incriminate Bianco by Carbonaro, who threatened to charge him with perjury if he did not testify against Bianco. Cayuga County District Attorney Carbonaro labeled the motion and the act of desperation, saying, quote, "It seems to me that the defense is grasping at straws," unquote. In February of 1992, due to persistence, Judge Patrick Monistrate of Brome County would clear the way for a new trial for Bianco. Judge Monistrate would rule that Bianco's trial was filled with prejudice due to the fact that the prosecution would not allow access to key police interviews conducted by investigators. At this point, Bianco has served 6 years of his 25-year-to-life sentence and would be taken back to Cayuga County for a bail hearing. Bianco's lawyer, Joseph Fahey, said, quote, "I told him the day he was sentenced that no matter how long it took or what it took, we would not rest until we got this vacated, reversed, or resolved satisfactorily," unquote. Fahey's argument would be that the evidence kept from the defense would show that Bianco did not kill Julie and that others were involved in her kidnapping, assault, and murder. The current DA in 1991, District Attorney Vergeson, would testify that during an exhaustive examination of all the case papers, he did discover that Carbonaro had withheld information from the defense and the trial judge. That information was a 3-page police report that might have pointed to different suspects. March 20th, 1993, Bianco, who had spent 6 years in prison fighting for his conviction, would finally get his conviction dismissed. Supreme Court Justice Monistrate said he was compelled to, quote, "undo the injustice," unquote, to Bianco because the former district attorney who prosecuted Bianco lied and suppressed evidence. He would say it is corruption that had preordained today's events. The Cayuga County District Attorney in 1993, James Vergeson, would announce at the court at the time that he had no plans to retry Bianco for kidnapping and murder or the assault because too much time had passed for him to win a second conviction with the available evidence. Ferguson said, quote, "I have concluded that the case against Thomas Bianco and its present form is not salvageable," unquote. Ferguson did say that Julie's case remains open and Bianco remains a suspect. Bianco was freed immediately after the verdict and was met by weeping family members and friends that engulfed him in hugs. Bianco said, quote, "Thank God, I want to thank all those who made this come to pass," unquote. Carbonaro would react with pure shock when learning about Monistrate's decision to overturn Bianco's conviction, saying, quote, "I am shocked by the attitude of the district attorney and the absurdity of the conclusion drawn by the judge, who is obviously not familiar with the facts in the case," unquote. Again, Carbonaro would insist that all the information they had gathered on the case was turned over to the defense team. We wouldn't hear anything about this case again until November 2022. District Attorney James Ferguson told the Citizen paper that he's unlikely to reopen the investigation into the 1981 kidnapping and murder of Julie, despite the petition that has garnered thousands of signatures. Ferguson said that he would need new information to justify such an action. However, Bianco's lawyer, Joseph Fahey, said Ferguson is the one that has the authority to reopen the probe and says the questions still remain about how the prosecutors of Cayuga handled the investigation into Julie's case from the beginning. Fahey, pointing specifically to District Attorney Paul Carbonaro and Dennis Sador, the former chief assistant, saying, quote, "There's an absolutely pervasive level of conduct as far as evidence withheld. It's a pervasive amount of misconduct bordering on corruption," unquote. Carbonaro and Sador to this day say the allegations are ridiculous and untrue. That brings us today. We are 42 years later, and Julie's case has still not been solved. Did investigators have tunnel vision on Bianco and completely miss out on their opportunity to find the real person or persons that took Julie's life? I don't know what it's going to take for Ferguson to reopen the investigation into Julie's murder, but I know public pressure can't hurt. To this day, it seems like Bianco has advocates in his corner, yet who's in Julie's corner fighting for her representation? There seems to be a community on Facebook of people fighting to get Julie's case reopened. Of course, with Facebook group comes drama, and it's quite hard to really understand who runs it and what exactly their purpose is. But there are people out there that have been following this case from the beginning and are pushing for Julie to get her justice. Now we need to be her representation, to be her voice, to make sure that she's heard by Cayuga County. The more we share Julie's case, the stronger and louder her voice gets. I think Julie's case perfectly points out why the investigation is so crucial to get right when these cases go to trial. I understand if the DA felt in his gut that this was the person responsible for Julie's murder and was going to do anything to get him convicted. Unfortunately, doing it that way will undo the conviction. There is no justice for a victim if we convict the wrong person, and there's no justice for a victim if we get a conviction for the right person and we lose it due to the investigation being corrupt. Nobody wins at that point. I'd love to know what you all thought. There's so much more to this case. I wanted to break it down in the most factual, friendly version. There's not a lot online, but there is a lot archived in newspapers that have so much information about Julie's case. It breaks my heart that a lot of it hasn't been put online, so hopefully this will help give her a stronger presence online as well. Thank you so much for listening to Julie's episode. I know this was a longer one that seemed like it had a conclusion, but this case is far from anyone having any answers as to what happened to Julie that night. Please share Julie's story on whatever platform you're comfortable with, even if that just includes word of mouth. If you're listening on Apple or Spotify, please take a moment to hit that subscribe and leave a review. That really helps get cases just like Julie's to more ears. Don't forget, when you see those missing and murdered posts on social media, to hit share, like, and retweet. Every time we share a face, we get closer to solving a case. Until next time.